come around here all the time. Got a lot to not do. Let me kill it with you.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. In 2023, the City of Kingston declared October as Plantiful Month, encouraging Kingstonians to explore plant-based food options, both for their health and the environment, during the month of October. 350 Kingston took the lead in providing workshops, seminars, and events for the community to learn more about plant-based options. At their last meeting, councillors passed a motion brought forward by Syndom Councillor Connie Glenn, taking another step towards supporting plant-based options. The motion sees the city commit to prioritizing and promoting plant-based food options, and collaborate with community partners on educational campaigns promoting the benefits of a plant-rich diet, emphasizing, quote, sustainability, health, and cultural appreciation. The reasoning behind the motion was rooted in promoting overall health for Kingstonians and moving towards the city's sustainability goals. The motion cites the Canada Food Guidelines, which recommend at least 75% plant-based foods, including fruits, vegetables, grains, and plant proteins for a healthy diet. It also cites our current food systems and practices' contribution to global greenhouse gas emissions. In the motion, it states that livestock production is responsible for about 14.5 to 28% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Dr. Henry Swoboda, a physician at Kingston Health Sciences Center, spoke to the motion before council.
We're talking about moving toward more plant-forward diets, which I believe are incredibly important for health. But you don't have to take my word for it. The Canada Food Guide very specifically says that we want to be primarily plant-based diets. If we do not change the way that we eat, the way that we do agriculture, our food environmental greenhouse gas budget will take up our entire greenhouse gas budget for everything by 2100. So we absolutely have to change the way that we eat. And this is a well-regarded as the number one way to improve that environmental benefit.
Councillor Glenn presented the motion to council.
This is really about some leadership in terms of the health of our community and the health of our environment. This is not a motion that pertains to telling other businesses what to do. It's about showing by example a different way forward in terms of how we eat. It does help with the environment. And this isn't anti anything other than saying that we need to start looking at things differently. This still allows for meat to be provided. It still allows for animal product to be provided. But what we're talking about is shifting the balance. We have a growing population, as we've well noted in the last bit of conversation we've had around this table. So if we continue down the path we're on and ever-increasing amounts of animal food, we're going to run into larger and larger environmental and health issues. The health impact that we're feeling community-wide is massive. increased rates of obesity, heart disease, diabetes. And this is the type of diet that helps to prevent all of those things. This, I think, is a reasonable motion that is, again, about moving that needle a little closer. All of the things that we're doing in terms of efforts to promote health and well-being, to take pressure off the healthcare system, which is overloaded, all of the initiatives that we're also working on towards addressing environmental and climate change, this is just another piece of that puzzle.
With the amendment by Councillor Brandon Tozzo, that city staff report back with a draft strategy to implement the initiative by Q4 2025, the motion was approved with a vote of 10-3. While the motion passed, it was not without controversy. Councillors Jimmy Hassan, Gary Osteroff, and Mayor Brian Patterson were the three opposing votes. Councillor Hassan brought up the first concerns.
I'm surprised that I have to learn from my colleagues, from my politician, who I have no expertise on, to tell me what to eat, what not to eat. It's my tummy, it's my health, it's my choice, what should I eat? And I should be responsible. This is not our job to tell the people what to do, what not to do, especially when it's come to the food.
Councillor Osteroff, representing the rural district of Countryside, raised concerns about local farmers.
From a rural perspective, I'm disappointed in the motion because I think that even the fourth clause referring to the livestock portion and the impact of agriculture and raising of animals, I think that there's plenty of science that indicates that these numbers are probably inaccurate. You know, I'm almost offended by that line because I think it's playing with numbers. I think it's quite inaccurate. And some of the language in here, I don't find it friendly. I find actually Dr. Svoda was more invitational to us. I think it should be an invitation for us to participate. And I don't like to read in the therefore clauses where always ensuring and primary. It just feels forced to me.
After the 30-minute discussion, most councillors agreed it was the right choice to move forward with the initiative.
My primary concern about this, well, there are two, which Councillor Osteroff touched upon, to not be imposing a condition upon our rural Kingstonians who are in the agricultural business, and to avoid any potential unintended disruptions to the ecosystem with regards to those businesses and either our suppliers or them acting as suppliers or with businesses that we have contracts with. So I think that this approach is a bit more responsible. It allows staff to come back with those recommendations. So I will be in support of this. And I truly, truly hope that at the next barbecue, there's still a meat burger option because I will gladly partake in that. But I do think that it's also important to highlight the vegetarian options as well. And I think this is a good step forward.
I think that this really does capture something that we really should be doing as the city of Kingston, trying to promote, you know, local grown food.
This motion is not about turning vegetarian. I think that, sorry to say, like last year, we're reading too much into it.
Farmers grow a wide variety of things, including livestock. So I think we need to recognize that. This is just asking that we start to pay a bit more attention and show a little bit of leadership, particularly in terms of the health elements. In terms of the experts, this is from the Canada Food Guide. Trust me, the experts have gone over it again and again and again, and they've rewritten it multiple times. The motion also isn't prescriptive. It's encouraging. It's about moving that needle. So there aren't targets that are laid out in here where we're saying tomorrow there must be this amount. This is about saying, okay, we're going down this pathway. Let's start on that prioritization.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
I can assure everyone at the next mayor's barbecue that there will be regular burgers as well as veggie burgers. Thank you.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is your sports report. The Queen's Gaels were in action on Saturday for their homecoming clash against the Waterloo Warriors at Richardson Memorial Stadium. The Gaels entered the contest with a 4-3 record and playoffs already guaranteed. The Warriors, on the other hand, entered the game with an 0-7 record looking for their first win of the season in the final game of the season. The Gaels got the scoring started early as Anthony Leo would connect with Nathan Falcone on this play early in the first quarter.
We got Nico Cuomo on the right side in isolation. However, this pass is going to be slung over the middle. Nathan Falcone, a beautiful pass and catch from Anthony Leo to Nathan Falcone to get the Gaels on the board early here at Richardson Memorial Stadium.
It was a historic day for two Gaels in particular. All-Canadian kick returner Ian St. Arnaud crossed the 1,000-yard threshold, setting a new mark of excellence for the Gaels, and running back Jared Kasari, with this carry early in the first quarter, found himself rewriting the record books as well.
The Gaels 54. It's going to be another handoff to Kasari. And Kasari, he has got a first down and then some. He is running, cutting, weaving through traffic. And he nearly had the ball stripped, but he kept it moving. And that will move him past the great Brad Elberg for sixth place on the all-time rushing list. Following his block, such an intelligent young man, such a smart, cerebral runner, and ever explosive.
Late in the first half of Saturday's game, backup quarterback and multi-position athlete Russell Weir would tally the play of the game with a designed quarterback sneak that would turn into something truly special.
As Russell Weir, instead of just sneaking it straight forward, is breaking out on the right-hand side. Russell Weir has got one man to beat, and he will do so. Number two on a quarterback sneak breaks it wide and gives the Gaels six more points. Mr. Do-It-All did it all on that one. 31-0 for the Gaels with a chance to make it 32.
Russell Weir's 60-yard touchdown scamper gave the Gaels a 32-0 lead heading into the half. The Waterloo Warriors would respond early in the third quarter with a 1-yard touchdown run from quarterback Nick Orr, but the Gaels would bounce right back with this touchdown throw from Anthony Leo to fourth-year wide receiver Nico Cuomo.
Going through his progressions, looking for Nico Cuomo. Cuomo, my goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown deep in the Gaels end zone. Put 6 points on the board. Beautiful pass from Anthony Leo. Nico Cuomo, his third big play of the day. That's why we call him Big Play Quay. My goodness, have yourself a day, Nico Cuomo.
The Gaels would go on to win 54-7, securing their second consecutive 5-3 regular season record and setting up a playoff rematch with the 5-3 Windsor Lancers. These two teams met in the season opener on August 24th, a game that Windsor won at home by a score of 25-21. Kickoff is scheduled for 4 p.m., but do tune in at 3:45 for the Something in the Water pregame show. From the CFRC Sports Desk, this is Jesse Bell, signing off and wishing you all nothing but the best. This is Jesse Bell with your weekly traffic report for the Kingston region. Pavement rehabilitations will take place along Highway 401 between Westbrook Road to beyond the Highway 15 overpass and on to the Sir John A. McDonald overpass. This work will consist of various lane and ramp closures over the next several months. Highway 401 eastbound at Highway 15, full mainline closure, October 21st, 9 p.m. to 6 a.m., October 22nd, 9 p.m. to 6 a.m., October 23rd, 9 p.m. to 6 a.m., and October 24th, 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. The Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard ramps will be closed October 22nd through 24th, 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. Road closures. Princess to 486 Albert Street is closed until December 31st to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street at Stewart Street is closed until 7 p.m. tonight for road reconstruction. Charles Street, Bagot to Montreal, is closed until October 25th to accommodate new utilities installations. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Hillcrest Avenue, Kings Court to 7th, is closed until October 31st for buried infrastructure replacement. Road will be open to local traffic only. Kings Court Avenue, Hillcrest to Kirkpatrick, is closed until November 15th to accommodate a water main replacement. The Tragically Hip Way to Place d'Armes is closed October 23rd at 8 p.m. to October 25th at 4 a.m. for event-related storage and parking for the Arkells at Slush Puppy Place. Union Street, Willingdon to Albert, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. University Avenue, Union to Earl, is closed for construction-related activity at the Queen's J-Duck. Wellington Street, Maine to George, is closed until October 22nd to accommodate construction-related activity for the Berryfield Highlands Subdivision Project. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen Street for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Bay Ridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd, expect delays while a contractor begins phase two of the Bay Ridge Drive active transportation upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles / Edwin to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes phase two of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard at Elmwood, expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road.
Thanks so much. On Monday evening, Kingston Jazz Society presents a free concert by Chantal Thompson at the RCHA running from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. Folks can also head over to the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts to enjoy the Dragon of Wantley performance starting at 7:30. Tickets start at $10. On Tuesday evening, head over to the RCHA from 4 to 7 p.m. for another great edition of the weekly Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam, a free event. You can also drive out to the Cove Inn and see pop folk artist Nolan Hubbard from 5 to 8 p.m. by donation. On Wednesday, you can take a ride on the Wolf Island Ferry and pop by the Open Mic Night by Mike Rapkins at Hotel Wolf Island, a free show starting at 7 o'clock. On Thursday, check out Ben Kaplan along with Princess Towers at Broom Factory from 7:30 to 10 p.m. Tickets are $25. The Saxabells are also playing a free show that evening starting at 5 p.m. at the RCHA. Jen Calder is also playing live originals and special favorites for free at the Grizzly Grill from 8 to 11 p.m. on Thursday. Coming up on Friday, you can see Miel Azevedo, Lily and Dillygaff for free at Hotel Wolf Island from 8:30 onward. The mansion also hosts a short walk to Pluto, the Vanier's in Montgomery on Friday starting at 8 p.m. Tickets are $15 at the door. Slush Puppy Place will also have the Arkells with Poolside playing on the Big Feelings Tour on Friday night starting at 8:30. Tickets start at $41. Also on Friday, KPP Concerts presents Sky Wallace and Ash Malloy at the Broom Factory starting at 7:30. Tickets are $20. On Saturday, you can check out the Big Fat Horn Band for $30 at the RCHA starting at 8 p.m. Also on Saturday, the Grad Club presents My Chem Echo Romance featuring Echoes, Hollowood, and Shook Planet from 9:30 onward. Tickets are $15 at the door. You can also enjoy the live premiere of Austin Wintory's Traveler, A Journey Symphony at the Isabel. Tickets range from $10 to $52 that evening. And also on Saturday night, The Mansion is hosting a pop-punk emo night featuring Monac, Futura Free, The Backsteps, Alterna, and The Listen Ups. Tickets are $10 for this five-band show starting at 8:30. And on Sunday, check out some lovely folk music by Eric and Megan at the Cove Inn, a by-donation event starting at 5 o'clock. And Roswell Rehearsals is also hosting an open celebration jam at their new space. Tickets are $20 and the fun starts at 4 p.m. And now moving over to the community events calendar for this week, folks can head over tonight from 5:25 to 7 p.m. for loggers and joggers at Riverhead Brewing Company. Be sure to dress for current jogging weather. The Brass and One-Eyed Jacks will also host their weekly trivia games as well on Monday night, starting at 7 and 7:45 respectively. Also on Monday, head over to the Kingston Penitentiary to enjoy Pumpkin Inferno from 7:15 to 8:45. Tickets are $21. On Tuesday, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. You can also grab your runners and head over to Lululemon that evening at 5:30 for a weekly fun run. Jog, mingle, and have fun, and the run is for all ages and abilities. Also on Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m., there's a newcomer men's group hosted by Immigrant Services Kingston, an area where newcomer men can meet other newcomers at 837 Princess Street. And folks can also enjoy Terror Tuesday at Fort Henry with a screening of the horror film Us. Tickets are $15 and the show starts at 8 p.m. On Wednesday, head over to the Rideau Heights Community Center for the Fresh Food Pop-Up Market, featuring fresh, healthy, and affordable food options between 2 and 5 p.m. Also on Wednesday, Kingston Community Health Centers is hosting a fun and friendly craft session from 9:30 until noon, a drop-in opportunity for folks who want to drop in on Wednesdays this fall and meet new friends and craft away. Folks can also enjoy weekly singing for self-care, connection, and a more beautiful world at the Fiercely OK weekly singing community held at Chalmers United Church, a drop-in session starting at 7 p.m. Something in the Water Brewing and Daft Brewing are also hosting their trivia night starting at 7 o'clock, and One Eye Jacks will host North End Board Games Night starting at 7. On Thursday, Kingston Community Health Centers will host a senior social group for individuals 55 plus from 9:30 to 11:30 p.m. And on Thursday, starting at 7:15, folks can enjoy Dark Night at Fort Fright, a weekly event running through Halloween. Enjoy scary attractions with costumed actors with your family and friends. Tickets start at $30. And the Domino Theater is hosting performances of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde through November 2nd. Tickets range from $10 to $20. And of course, the Grad Club right here at Queen's University is running its free and hugely popular weekly trivia night every Thursday, starting at 8 o'clock. On Friday, October 25th, the YMCA will also host its weekly fresh food market from 9:30 to 12:30, a great opportunity to get fresh food at great prices. And also on Friday, Pumpkin Inferno at Kingston Pen is still running various days through the end of October. Check out amazing hand-carved pumpkin exhibits with family. Admission is $16 to $21. On Saturday, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. Also on Saturday, there is a casting call for a short film called A Christmas Story in Kingston. Actors of any gender that look 14 to 19 years of age or 30 to 50 years of age can head over to Pedalworks Cafe and Studio between 2 to 4 p.m. Inquiries should be directed to info@creatopiastudios.com. Also on October 26th from 9 to 2 p.m., the Sydenham Women's Institute is holding their Fall Craft and Bake Sale, an event showcasing a variety of local vendors selling homemade artisan gifts and delicious homemade baking. The event takes place at Golden Links Hall, 4186 Colebrook Road in Harrowsmith, and admission is free. And also on Saturday, October 26th, don't forget to head over to the Broom Factory between 1 and 3 p.m. to hang out with lots of amazing bands at the Music Merch Market. CFRC will also be there DJing. Stop by our booth. And on Sunday, get up and head over to Runner's Choice for an early morning long run starting at 8:30 a.m. with your friends. Folks and families can also head over to Fort Henry on Sunday and multiple dates through the end of October for Fort Fright to check out the Ghouls and Goblins, special effects and sound, and amazing actors starting at 7:15 through 11 p.m. Admission is $25. Also on Sunday, October 27th, the team at Martha's Table Community Program will host the annual Empty Bowls Fundraiser 2024 at Doubletree by Hilton at 1550 Princess Street. Come and support a great cause while enjoying a variety of soups, take home a handmade bowl from the Kingston Potters Guild, listen to live music, and bid on amazing silent auction items. Tickets can be purchased at marthastable.ca. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 2 p.m. featuring food, artisanal crafts, and music. Have a concert or event you would like to add to our online or on-air calendar? Reach out to us today via cfrc.ca. And don't forget to follow us on CFRC on Instagram at cfrcmusic.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. And coming up now in this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a track from folk artist Anthea Fever's debut album called Summer's Morning. Recorded at Neptune's Machine on Wolf Island, the 10-song collection covers themes of love, trauma, and recovery. The arrangements range from sombre to uplifting, driven by Fever's poignant lyricism and deftly fingerpicked guitar. The album, which shines a light on the intricate balance between bleakness and hope, will be available on streaming platforms and as a CD. Anthea Fever is also having an album release show on October 19th at Next Church at 7:30 p.m., supported by Alexander Gallant. In the meantime, let's enjoy this song by Anthea Fever called Bedtime Story on Release Radar, right here on CFRC.
Walking heart in hand, and I've been looking for someone to wear their beating heart upon their sleeve. In my chest there is a hole, it don't take much to make it whole. Just tell me that you'll walk here next to me and be my bedtime story. I've been reading lots of books, and boy, I think it would be good if you the words out loud to me. If the pages come alive, then we'll have nothing left to hide, and we could write away, and you could be my bedtime story. Your head is a secret garden, darling, oh I beg your pardon, won't you take a walk around with me? Oh, the trees, they start to dance, and I have never been in trance like this before, and that is why you'll be my bedtime story. Oh, come to my bed, pour your fairy dust over my head, leave your shadow in my drawer, and take me by the hand. My bedtime story. Tell me all the places you've been and every little thing you've seen, and maybe now you won't do that alone. You can show me all your dark, and I'll let you see all my scars, and each of us will call each other home, my bedtime story. We can delve into the forest, everybody will ignore us, you can build a nest up in the trees. I've never been afraid of dying, but I am afraid of trying, just to be shoved back on my knees, my bedtime story. I can teach you how to rhyme, and you can teach me how to fly, and we will be poets up in the sky. You've spent your life believing you're only made for leaving. I'd stay by your side until I die, my bedtime story. To my bed, pour your fairy dust over my head, leave your shadow in my drawer, take me by the hand out the door. Oh, come to my bed, pour your fairy dust over my head, leave your shadow in my drawer.
This is CFRC 101.9 FM, your campus and community radio station, broadcast from the basement of Kerutas Hall, Queen's University, Kingston. You can also hear this program locally on Cogeco Cable, Channel 282, and is streamed online at cfrc.ca.
Welcome to Biotech Beat. This is your host, Chris Rao. Today we will hear a discussion on the topic, Effective Future for Precision Medicine. This program was produced and distributed by World Economic Forum. Before that, a few messages.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program is planting seedlings across five regions of the country: BC, the Prairies, Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic. They plant in areas that are in need of reforestation or afforestation across Canada. Tree Canada selects sites where appropriate native species will be planted to make sure that natural forests come back to life. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband Tom and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it. So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
CFRC is active on every social media platform. Check us out at CFRC Radio on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, and on Twitter at CFRC.
A dive into the exciting and emerging area of precision medicine. It's technologies that are going to revolutionize healthcare and tailor it to the individual. My name is Robert Speight. I direct the Engineering Biology Future Science Platform at the National Science Agency for Australia, the CSIRO. It's my great pleasure this morning to introduce our two speakers and my colleagues from the Global Future Council for Synthetic Biology. So first, Dr. Megan Frisk. She's the Director of International Affairs at the U.S. Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, or ARPA-H for short. Her role is to advance international strategy and collaborations for global benefit. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you.
Secondly, Dr. Faisal Khan. He's the Director and Principal Investigator at the Precision Medicine Laboratory in Pakistan's National Center for Big Data and Cloud Computing, spanning genomics, systems, and synthetic biology, and targeting oral cancer. He's got a strong history with the World Economic Forum, being a young global leader in 2019. It's my pleasure to hand over to our speakers to tell you about precision medicine.
Thanks, Rob, and thanks, everyone, for coming down. I think it would be nice to start off with what we actually mean by precision medicine. The NIH definition goes by using a person's information on their genes, environment, and lifestyle to be able to prevent, diagnose, and treat disease. So this clearly goes beyond just your routine clinical exams or labs and scans, and it delves deeper into what are those genes that underlie the disease that a person has, like, for example, cancer. In many cases, we also know the specific changes in each of those genes, mutations as we call them, that guides treatment, and it points at drugs that could be more effective in a particular disease in a specific patient. This offers a transformative way of doing medicine in a very personalized manner. But cancer care is just one of those case studies that we can talk about. In many cases, for example, we're able to use information about your metabolic genes to optimize your drug dosage whenever you treat it. And one example from what we're doing in our lab with cardiothoracic surgeons, for example, is delving into mutations in some genes that influence the diameter of your blood vessels, something really important for heart disease treatment. But precision medicine is not just about improving treatment. It's also about avoiding ineffective treatment, which saves a lot of associated cost and pain, not just for the patients, but their households. And we all know a single incidence of such a disease in a family can push the entire household beneath the poverty line. So how has the field been faring over the years? We've seen a rapid and steep increase in the number of genomic data sets out there. This is just one large publicly available database. And we see an inflection point right after the Human Genome Project here. And it's a logarithmic scale, so it's exponential. And we see it getting steeper up here at the top. It's almost, the volume is almost doubling every 18 months, which is substantial. This is underlined by a more exponential drop in costs of DNA sequencing technologies. The same sequencing technology stack is being used to look into other molecules, like RNA, for example. A whole RNA-seq dataset for a patient tells you about which genes are expressed, which are not, and if they are, how much are they being expressed in a particular situation. And in recent years, we've also seen the use of the same stack for single-cell sequencing. This is high-resolution sequencing, which looks at individual cells within an individual tumor and give us insights about a person's disease. And finally, with AI, I think it's getting even more exciting. We have data sets available in biology and medicine, and I'm really looking forward to how GenAI is leveraged in the coming days. In Pakistan, we've launched our precision medicine pilot funded by the federal government through the Higher Education Commission. It's a modest start, but with a very strong conviction that we want to leverage these genomic data sets and tools, develop local data sets, and be able to preempt, hopefully avoid disparities that could happen in the future. Our focus for the pilot is on oral cancer. Pakistan's the fifth largest country in the world by population, and oral cancer stands right beneath breast cancer as one of the leading diseases in the country. We've also, instead of using a linear approach of looking at the genes first, we went on with a parallel approach by looking at layers of, by looking at a wide range of molecules, which gives us layers of complementary data sets that is richer to explore. Of course, we had machine learning experiments in mind, but again, with the advent of GenAI, it's getting even more exciting. This entire multi-omic stack is backed by a biorepository which banks all the samples, including patient-derived cell lines for each individual patient, offering a personalized preclinical model for follow-up studies. Over to Megan.
Thank you. So Faisal has talked about the why and the what, and I would like to talk a little bit about the how. Let's take a step forward. How do we make precision medicine a reality? How do we make it the norm? We need to make big bets on bold ideas if we're really going to transform this field and bring it into reality. We need to take that step forward and ask ourselves, what if? What if a single at-home test could save millions of lives by detecting cancer early? What if we could adapt cancer treatments even as the tumors mutate and change? What if we could 3D print a human heart in 1 hour? or a liver or a kidney. And what if we could have our own bodies manufacture the cures for devastating diseases? How do we do this? How do we speed up this type of innovation? In the United States, we've launched the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, or ARPA-H, as this answer to speeding up innovation. We're using a business model that was pioneered by our sister agency, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. DARPA may be known to some of you as that agency that has given us things like the internet, or stealth and GPS technologies, or those early proof of concept studies on the mRNA vaccines that saved so many lives and livelihoods during COVID-19. So using this model, we're investing in what we call the high-risk, high-reward space, that in-between space. The space where the impossible ideas cannot be achieved by traditional biomedical research alone or by industry investment. Many of you may think of this in-between space as the Valley of Death. Probably heard that. We've taken to calling it the Valley of Opportunity. This is where we want to de-risk these wild ideas, these bold ideas. We want to be that investor in that middle space, take on that proof of concept or that minimum viable experiment that will really crack open a whole new field. But taking risk can make some parts of the health ecosystem feel unsteady or uncomfortable. And I'm not talking about casual or careless approach to risk. I'm talking about combining deep technical expertise with business rigor. And for that, we rely on special people we call program managers. Program managers come to us with their idea, their what-if question. They put resources behind it, and then they fund a teams of performers, which are researchers in our lingo. We fund multiple shots on goal, diversifying our risk. Research metrics are tracked, metrics and milestones are tracked very rigorously over time, very short period of time. So we're a short-term investor, something close to 3, 4, 5 years. And we do not expect all solutions to succeed. Some may be ahead of their time. We may need to reallocate funds along the way. Program managers may halt work that is failing, but what they will do is adjust course as necessary. At only 2 years old, we've already started making some very pivotal investments across the entire spectrum of human health. But what I want to share with you is just a couple of the ideas, those what-if statements that I'm talking about, a couple of those specific to the precision medicine field. One program is called ADAPT, Advanced Analysis for Precision Cancer Therapy. ADAPT is really looking at the current cancer treatment landscape for metastatic cancers. Right now, a very limited number of measurements are taken on a tumor and used to inform treatment decisions, and often not updated to reflect the tumor as it mutates and changes. What ADAPT will do is fund those teams of researchers to take many different types of measurements of the tumor, including omics, be able to combine those with advanced computational tools, artificial intelligence, machine learning, mathematical modeling, and what we hope comes out the other end is a set of biomarkers that will better inform treatment decisions and improve survival and outcomes in patients with metastatic cancers. Another program is called Embody, engineering the immune cells inside the body. This is really taking a look at cell therapies today and how much potential they have, but how inaccessible and costly they are for us. Right now, traditional cell therapy approach is very technically complex. It requires substantial patient involvement. It's very costly. It's around $100,000 per dose per patient just to produce. It's time consuming. Many patients die while waiting for these cell therapies. And fourth, it's not very accessible. In the United States, it's available, these cell therapies are available in fewer than 2% of clinics and hospitals. So what Embody seeks to do is develop platform technologies that will engineer or edit the cells inside your body and be able to respond to disease cues and produce the therapies or the treatments that are needed. If we're able to do this, well, we can remove most of those barriers to cost, time, access, manufacturing, and so forth. As I mentioned, we're funding a gamut of work across the health research or across the health and healthcare spectrum. These were just two examples, but what we do expect is that when we succeed, everyone stands to benefit.
To be fair, precision medicine's idea has been out there for a while now, which begs the question, why haven't we seen wider adoption? But we saw it's not technological barriers that are limiting us. It's perhaps broader systems-level challenges that lie outside the laboratory. From our work in precision medicine in a rather nascent ecosystem, I'd love to share some early lessons that we have. In many cases, the government might not be the main driver in such large projects. It might take groups of progressive science leaders on the ground that could do their job. We need to be open to new ways, new non-traditional ways of rallying coalitions and consortia to execute such projects. No single entity is able to pull something like this off. We need multiple teams across multiple sites that are interdisciplinary in nature and have a wide range of skill sets. This means we require team science, and we need to build critical masses around projects like precision medicine. There's often a temptation amongst policymakers to take such work everywhere, but we see value in building densities and creating synergies in a more concentrated manner. Sometimes things go much faster if they're housed outside the usual structures, like we saw with ARPA-H. This could be another innovation in terms of execution. Consumables and perishables are one of the biggest challenges in doing biomedical research in a developing country context. I'm fully aware that something like this is totally taken for granted in established labs across the world. But this means governments need to innovate their public procurement processes, and perhaps vendors have a bigger role to learn from local nuances and help enable more and more research on the ground. Many of these large, fast-growing cities across the developing world have pockets of densities or economic clusters that could be leveraged. In healthcare, for example, these are amazing grounds for rigorous large clinical studies and trials, including projects like precision medicine. This is not just in terms of size and volume, but also diversity, the diversity of people who show up at these clusters in terms of genetic background. Many of these clusters are brimming with sharp and smart young talent, which needs to be leveraged. Countries like Pakistan, for example, my province, 70% of the population is below the age of 30. These include some really smart doctors, data scientists, and biologists, which is exactly what you want for interdisciplinary projects like precision medicine. Over to Megan.
Faisal's absolutely right. It makes no difference if everything that we invest in ultimately just sits on a shelf. We need to have the right structure around the research to enable that transition potential, be able to translate these types of inventions in precision medicine into the real world. So at ARPA-H, we have taken this into account and really built some key features into the function or the operations of our agency. One is to ensure that the programs are designed with that translation potential in mind, thinking about the market, thinking about the patients, understanding the potential trajectory, not just in the United States, but also around the world. Two, making sure that we're sourcing ideas from everywhere. We need to bring fresh ideas, novel ideas, into the pipeline as well, so that we can have innovation that reflects everybody. So how do we do this structurally? For programs that I mentioned, like ADAPT or EMBODY, to survive in the wild, is what we say, or go on to live in the real world, they really need other stakeholders to meet them where they are. We're funding the researchers to go after these risky ideas, these big problems, but we need others to come to the table and meet them where they are. So we see ourselves at ARPA-H as a catalyst, not the only solution, the catalyst within this wider ecosystem. So we very intentionally work across our own government, other funders within the government. We need to work with industry. We need to work with investors. We need to work with the international community. So we're here to collaborate and make sure that the solutions that we are investing in actually come out and impact patients' lives. But we're a small agency. We're really only, I think, around 200 federal employees. So how do we do this at scale? How do we know what patients want or need everywhere, what doctors will use everywhere, what investors will invest in anywhere? We have created and launched a hub-and-spoke network to do exactly this, to reach out into the communities. We have a hub in Dallas that's meant to engage customers, doctors, patients, providers, community health workers, and a hub in Boston that's meant to engage the investor community to help us understand that commercialization potential. With these two hubs, we have, I think at this point, over 900 spokes, not just in the United States, but around the world. And these are public and private and non-government entities that are willing to work with us on these game-changing solutions. The second point I made about fresh vision and voices, solutions can come from anywhere, and we want to bring them to us. So lots of entities that are smaller, small companies, labs, nonprofits, they may not know how to do business with the U.S. government. So we need to lower that barrier to interact with us. So we're not only innovating in the research, we're also innovating in the way we do business. So take, for example, our Sprint for Women's Health, which we launched earlier this year. I know it's not a precision medicine example, but our Sprint for Women's Health that we launched earlier this year. We asked for only a 3-page abstract from proposers, not a 150-page one, not one that's going to take months to write, hundreds of thousands of dollars or resources to put behind it, a 3-page abstract. And from there, we could select which abstracts or which solutions that we wanted to pitch us. From there, we can select the winners. They'll be announced very soon. So we're making decisions quickly, nimbly, flexibly, working with the community. And we think we've achieved what we set out to do, which is lowering that barrier. We received solutions from 34 countries in addition to the United States, within the United States from 45 states plus the District of Columbia. And of those submissions, over 40% of them were from entities with fewer than 10 people. That's lowering the barrier, and that's bringing those innovative voices to the table. So we started this meeting yesterday talking about hopefulness. So what I wanted to leave you with was a hope for the future of precision medicine. What does it look like 10 years from now? 10 years from now, maybe we're all back here at the World Economic Forum talking about precision medicine as a reality, not a question mark, whether we will be able to do precision medicine, but that we actually are doing it. And we're sitting around talking about the precision therapies that we've each received and how it has impacted the lives of ourselves and of our loved ones. The next step in getting to that reality is to take a leap of imagination and embrace risk, because remember, the patients are waiting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Megan and Faisal, for a fantastic overview of both the technology but also the deployment and social aspects that are inherently important if these technologies are going to see the light of day. We have about 10 minutes for questions. I've got several. If anybody's got a burning question in the audience, put your hand up. But I'd just like to start. I think it's very inspiring, Megan, where you talk about the networks and the global engagement and the potential of this technology to be deployed globally. But what does that global landscape look like? Who's engaged around the world? Who's doing what? What does it look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think owing to a lot of the things that Faisal mentioned at the beginning in terms of the lowered cost of sequencing, the accessibility of the technology, and I think so many governments around the world and private sector recognizing the vast potential of precision medicine, I think we're seeing an uptick in investments and interest in these national level genome initiatives, sequencing human genomes across the world. Of course, we have this in the United States. There's a program, of course, in the UAE. We also see this in Singapore and in Japan and in Denmark, the UK. So these countries, Pakistan, these countries are really all over the world investing in genomic medicine.
And are these connected as well, or is that something for the future?
Yeah, I think it's something we do more and more here in the future. There's quite a bit of collaboration and connectivity, and I think Faisal could absolutely speak to that. But if we want to make sure precision medicine is representative of patients all over the world, we need to bring this data to bear on these solutions, and that looks different everywhere. And so how do we collaborate to make that a reality?
Yeah, Faisal, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, so I mean, the earlier bit is about data generation, right? When you do undertaking the genomic part of it is basically creating the data set. I think the actual excitement then begins after that when you begin to analyze the data. I think that's where collaboration will be even more critical and exciting from a scientific perspective as well. So I think all eyes on the downstream analysis and how countries begin to talk to each other and share these resources.
So this is kind of, it's a big data play.
Absolutely.
You talked about the stack and all the different types of data. We're talking about people's genomes as well. On one hand, we need collaboration, I guess, to aggregate data sets so we can learn, we can train AI, things like that are going to help. But what are the considerations on the flip side of that around security and equity around the data? How do we ensure that this is equitably deployed and managed going forward?
There is broader consensus on the patient privacy part of it. I think across the world, we see the consensus that that has to be taken care of. And there are standards in place on how to do that. Some hospitals are very open about it. Others sign up patients at every footfall. So there are varying models people can adopt. But I think the biggest challenge will be how do we get access to a worldwide genomic data set, which is representative of different ethnic backgrounds. I think that's the key challenge. How do we enable countries which are not yet investing in these technologies to be able to come up and share their genomes in the broader pool? Because for me, that's the source of all the inequities. If these populations are left out, that's, I think, not a great trajectory to be on.
Yeah, so there's deliberate steps that are required to do that. I was wondering as well, Megan, from ARPA-H's perspective, is that equity piece something that you build into the programs?
Oh yes.
That's it, folks. Tune in for another round of Biotech Beat, same time next week.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this October at the Broom Factory featuring some of your favorite big-name acts and a few local gems as well. On October 18th, it's a hometown rock show as the Wilderness hit the stage with support from the Astros. October 19th sees Kingston's own Luscious welcome Feral Minx from Hamilton to the Broom with local rockers Pound Salt getting things started early. On October 24th, don't miss Canadian